Chapter 32. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 15th, 2012, Day 11. "This town is buzzing with state police," Ray said as she walked through the kitchen. She went to the front of the apartment and looked down on Maple Street. "I mean, they're all over the place. There's another one parked across the street." "This is all for me?" Kelsey asked. "And your doctor friend. What did Detective Madison tell you downstairs?" "Not much. I asked why he was looking for you, and he told me it was a police matter. Asked if I knew Dr. Ambrose."
"What did you say?"
"No, because I don't technically know him. I only know about him. So I figured I wasn't really lying to a cop, right?" Ray thought for a moment. "Where's your car?"
"At the Winchester."
"I'm sure they found it by now, so they know you're still in town. Can't walk off this mountain, and there are only so many places to hide in this little town." Kelsey opened her palms. "I'm writing a magazine article. What the hell?" She joined Ray at the front window and through the curtains watched the activity below. Uniformed officers walked along Maple Street, in and out of establishments. They should have been this concerned when Becca was killed. Maybe they'd have figured things out by now.
"Did you find the journal, by the way?"
Kelsey forgot she had Becca's journal in her purse. She nodded.
"In Millie's recipe book."
"Figures. Read any of it?"
"Yes, all of it last night, before I fell asleep."
"Where?"
"After I dropped Millie off and sucked down a sweet tea in her kitchen, I wanted to make sure you didn't make a mess that she'd call the police about. I came over to the Winchester, but you didn't answer."
"Oh, I went to Peter's place and stayed the night."
"Really?"
"I fell asleep on his couch."
"Anything else going on?"
"I've got police at every corner of this town looking for me, and you're concerned about my love life?"
"I'm concerned about everyone's love life. You'd be shocked what people tell me over coffee."
Kelsey just looked at her and shook her head.
"Currently, I'm concerned with keeping the two of us out of jail."
Kelsey turned her back to Ray and looked out the front window again. "I need to make sure he's okay."
"Call him."
He didn't answer. She closed the curtains. "How am I going to get out of here?"
"You broke into a building. That doesn't carry a life sentence. Or any jail time, I bet."
"So what's all this for?" Kelsey said, gesturing toward the window.
"Becca, for sure. Like you suspected, Becca's father wants the details of her death to emerge on his terms, not yours."
"What did you find in the journal?"
"Names of Becca's friends, including the guy she married, plus a few other guys who were part of her life."
"How so?"
"It turns out Becca was quite a social butterfly, maybe a bit of a manipulator of men. It's hard to tell just from journal entries, but she had lots of relationships with lots of men when she was killed."
"I could see why her father wouldn't want that coming out. So what's the plan?"
"There are no last names in the journal, so I've got some field work to do to ID the men who are part of Becca's life. Peter is tracking down Becca's old roommate to see what she knows about Becca and the guy she married. I was going to start looking into the other men in Becca's life."
Kelsey looked out the window one last time at the police activity. "I'm not sure I'll have the time to find them all."
"That's BS," Ray said. "You didn't get this far to give up now. We've got two computers here, internet access and coffee. It's all we need to track down some frat boys and law students."
Kelsey smiled. She picked up her MacBook and headed to the bedroom with Ray. Ray sat at her computer, Kelsey next to her with her laptop. She put Becca's journal on the desk between them and pulled out her notes. "Three guys, Brad, Richard, Tom, college friend, high school boyfriend, GWU professor." Ray tapped at her keyboard.
"Let's do some creeping. I'll take Brad, you take the professor."
Chapter 33. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, February 15th, 2012. 2 days before her death. January in the nation's capital was bitter cold, with winds off the Potomac that rattled teeth and sent people scurrying for shelter. The first month of the year also marked the official beginning of the election season, and Milt Ward stormed into Iowa and took the caucus as if it were his birthright. With an incumbent president in office, there were no meaningful primaries for the other side, and as January unfolded and Super Tuesday approached,
The talking heads pitted the sitting president's ideas against those of Milt Ward. Everyone agreed the showdown in November would be fierce. Ward was on every cable news program, and Jack let Becca know over the phone which speeches he had written for the senator. It was an exciting time. By the beginning of February, Becca was deluged with keeping up with her classes and managing the end-of-the-day fatigue that came with her pregnancy. She learned to get her work completed by 7 or 8 at night, since she was rarely seeing a minute later. She fell asleep too many times on her couch, with notes around her and her textbook on her chest, to realistically think she could comprehend material during the evening hours. Instead, she packed her books away and climbed into bed each night around 8:30 and was gone to the world. On the second Tuesday in February, Milt Ward's only serious contender dropped out of the race and ended his campaign. 1 month before Super Tuesday, Becca watched Milt Ward and his campaign race around the country campaigning for votes. By the end of the night, his bid as the nominee for his party was inevitable. It was early and unprecedented. The country buzzed with the news, and the party celebrated as it got behind their candidate. Jack called at just past 10 p.m. to tell her the official news. They shared a quick conversation before he was off to prepare an acceptance speech. Jack was writing speeches for a man running for president, he reminded her, and potentially someone who would occupy the White House by the end of the year. It was a historic moment, and they shared it from hundreds of miles away. The next day, Becca lay on the table of her doctor's office while the technician ran a cold probe over her stomach. "Strong kid," the male technician said. "Bigger than normal for 23 weeks.
"Really?" Becca said. "Is that good or bad?"
"Neither really," the tech said. "He has a good heart rate, and everything looks perfect. Just a little bigger than usual. Maybe we've got the dates off by a couple of weeks. No big deal."
"A couple of weeks are a big deal. I need this baby to hang out in my womb until sometime after May 4th. Becca saw the tech squint his eyes. "I'm in law school, and I need to finish finals before this kid makes an appearance." The technician smiled as he logged information from the ultrasound into her chart. Without looking at her, he said,
"If I were a betting man, I'd say this kid's not going to wait until the middle of May. But talk to the doctor about it. She'll be right in and should be able to give you a better idea of the date."
An hour later, Becca was bundled in her wool coat with a scarf wrapped around her face as she headed to her car. The doctor had determined all was normal and that the baby was just bigger than usual for 23 weeks. Still, she moved Becca's due date up a week based on today's testing and explained the details of inducement if there were no signs of labor by the beginning of May. Becca fought hard to figure out how she might successfully complete her 1L year with a baby arriving in the middle of finals week. It was time to tell her parents. It was well past the time, really. They waited longer than they should, and with the due date a week earlier, it was time to come clean. It was looking more certain that to get through the year, especially with the recent campaign developments and the fact that Jack would be traveling, Becca would need to rely on her mom to get through her first year of school. She started her car and cranked the heat. She dialed Jack's cell phone, and he answered on the first ring.
"What did the doctor say?"
"We have a very healthy baby, and one who will arrive a week earlier than expected."
"Why is that?"
"The baby's totally healthy, just big. It's making Dr. Shepherd rethink the due date, which she now pushed up a week. And even if the baby doesn't want to come out until the due date, she won't let me go that long if the baby continues to grow at this pace. Delivery would be too difficult, and possibly dangerous because I'm small and our baby is big. So I'm having a baby right around finals, Jack. I don't know how we're going to do this."
"Okay," Jack said. "We'll figure it out."
"I've got to tell my parents. I don't know what we're thinking. They're going to find out, so I want to tell them. About the baby and about us being married. Everything. I know you keep saying we should wait, but I don't want to wait anymore."
"You're right," Jack said. "We're idiots for waiting this long."
"What are we doing, Jack? You're traveling all over the country. I'm barely keeping pace this semester. We've got this huge secret sitting on our shoulders, and we haven't even filed our marriage certificate yet."
"Yeah," Jack said. "Sorry, things are crazy here, but it'll calm down in a week or so."
"I just feel like, I don't know, is this whole thing real? Nobody knows about us being married or about the baby. It feels wrong.
like we're trying to hide it forever. I know this is going to screw up law school for me and probably interfere with your job, but we've got to do something. This baby has to start taking precedence instead of being something we keep trying to work around. Becca listened to Jack breathing through the phone. As he thought things over, she heard him rub his face, which was covered now with heavy scruff from working nonstop. Jack, I'm freaking out here.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. You're right, Becca.
Listen, she said, I need to get out of here for a while. I've got a test next week I've barely studied for because I can't stay awake past 8 o'clock. I'm going to ask my parents if I can use the Stilt House for a long weekend of studying.
Good idea, Jack said. Head up to Summit Lake. I'll meet you there on Saturday.
How?
I'll talk to Ward. Tell him I need some time. Simple as that. He'll understand. And if he doesn't, I'll quit. Either way, I'll meet you this weekend to collect our thoughts. Get things straight between us. Then we'll take a day next week to drive to Greensboro and tell your parents.
For real this time?
Absolutely.
They're going to freak out.
Probably, Jack said. They have a right to freak out. We're idiots. But guess what? They'll get over it, because in a few months, they'll have a grandkid they're going to love. And after a while, we'll all get over how we handled this. Let me talk to Ward and I'll call you back. Don't tell your parents anything without me.
Okay.
Promise me, Jack said.
Silence.
Promise me you won't say anything to your parents until we see each other.
I promise, Becca finally said. I won't talk to my parents.
I love you.
Me too, Becca said. She clicked her phone off and held it to her forehead, thinking of sitting in her parents' living room and telling them she had run off and gotten married and they would soon be grandparents and she might not finish law school. She shook her head and wiped the tears from her eyes. After her car warmed up, she drove to her apartment in Foggy Bottom. With an oversized purse on her shoulder and a bag of baked Ruffles in her hand, she shuffled from her car. It was almost 6 p.m., and the cold winter days pulled darkness over the city before 5 each night. She jogged through the parking lot under the yellow glow of halogen, while a wicked wind worked to prevent her progress. She struggled with the key as her frozen fingers stabbed at the lock. The frantic nature in which she ran from her car and now grappled with a deadbolt put a sense of urgency and fear into her. There was something else, too, an eerie feeling of another's presence. All of this transcended onto her in the seconds it took to fight the door open, which she finally did, and then quickly slammed it behind her, re-engaging the deadbolt as soon as the door hit the frame. She dropped her purse on the kitchen floor and threw the Ruffles on the table, running her hand over her frozen cheeks and wiping away the tears the cold night brought to her eyes. Her hands were shaking from the panic of wrestling her apartment door open.
"You're losing it," Becca said out loud.
She looked through the peephole and into the dark evening. She needed Jack, that was all. She needed his rational thinking to get past her fear of attempting to make it through finals with an infant, and his reassuring nature that was able to conquer any obstacle. She found solace in the idea that they would spend the weekend together. 2 hours before fatigue would steal her motivation to do anything but lay in bed, she needed to read 3 chapters of Con Law and get caught up on torts. She jumped in the shower to rejuvenate and warm herself. The panic that overcame her earlier faded as the hot water flowed over her body. Alone in the bathroom, her eyes closed and the roar of the shower filling her ears, she never heard the front door as the knob was tried from the outside. The deadbolt held, and after 3 attempts, the door went quiet. Chapter 34. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 15, 2012, Day 11. Here, Kelsey said. Got it. She was tapping the MacBook with efficiency, staring at the screen. Let me hear it, Ray said. She too was staring at her computer, working hard. Brad Reynolds lives in Maryland, at least his parents do. Father is a big league tort guy, attended GWU, part of Becca's freshman year enrollment. But out of all the Brads we've looked at, this is most likely the one mentioned in the journal. I found an internship program Becca was part of her sophomore year. Brad Reynolds participated in the same program. He also lived in the same co-ed dorm as Becca freshman year. No Facebook presence, but this has to be him, Where is he now? Ray asked.
No idea, but I have an address and phone number in Maryland. I'll start there.
Okay, Ray said. I've got two for you. The professor is Tom Jorgensen, former GWU professor of logic and critical thinking. Becca took his course sophomore year, got an A. Now he's on staff at Cornell University. Made the change during Becca's senior year. Phone number is no problem. We can reach him through the university.
Easy, Kelsey said.
There's a catch, though, Ray said.
What's that?
You say he and Becca had a relationship?
Of some sort. He's mentioned in her journal quite a bit. More in the earlier entries. Why?
Professor Jorgensen is married with two kids. So if he was involved with Becca...
Kelsey stared at Ray, then scribbled on her notepad. Okay, what else?
High school boyfriend, I'm almost sure, is Richard Walker. He went to Northwest Guilford High, same age as Becca, Harvard undergrad and now Harvard Law, which obviously you said Becca mentioned in her journal. An old Facebook posting shows him at the prom with Becca. He's our man.
Contact info? Kelsey asked.
Ray went back to the computer. Shouldn't be hard. We can get his phone number at Harvard. I'll look.
Kelsey grabbed the phone. I'll start with Brad Reynolds.
Kelsey dialed the Reynolds' home number in Maryland and held the phone to her ear. Check this out, Ray said, still working the keyboard. Richard Walker's family owns a vacation home right here in the foothills. Kelsey momentarily dropped the phone from her ear, eyes squinted.
Here? The foothills of Summit Lake?
Yep, Ray said with a smile. So we might not have to go far to find him. Plus,
it puts him in the vicinity the night Becca died.
Possibly. A faint voice captured Kelsey's attention, and she realized someone had answered the phone at the Reynolds household. She quickly put the phone back to her ear.
Hello, Mr. Reynolds?
Yes, my name is Kelsey Castle. I'm a reporter for Events Magazine, writing a story about Becca Eckersley. She was murdered a couple weeks back.
Uh-huh.
Well, I know she attended school with your son, Brad, and I was hoping to talk with him to get some information about Becca.
There was silence for several seconds as Kelsey listened to Mr. Reynolds.
Oh, Kelsey finally said, looking at Ray.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Part 4. Three Knocks. Chapter 35. Becca Eckersley, Summit Lake. February 17th, 2012, the day of her death. She skipped her Friday morning class and didn't worry about her afternoon study session. With the car packed the night before with anything that wouldn't freeze, Becca was on the road by 8 a.m. It was a 5-hour ride to the mountains and another hour or so to Summit Lake. She talked to Jack before she left. Milt Ward offered Jack all the time he needed, and Jack was arranging a flight for Saturday morning that would get him there by late afternoon. He settled on 4 days off, which were closely plotted to include 2 days in Summit Lake, Saturday and Sunday, 1 day in Greensboro for the long overdue talk with Becca's parents, and 1 day to get back to D.C. before he hit the road again with Senator Ward. That was the plan he offered, and Becca hungrily ate it up. She called her parents on the way up to let them know her progress and promised to call again when she arrived. With the extra bathroom stops, the trip took 7 hours. It was almost 3 p.m. when she pulled into the small drive at the front of the Stilt house. She dragged her bag from the trunk and dumped it in the bedroom, then ran out and brought in the groceries she bought the night before. Once she settled in the house and had the thermostat adjusted to a comfortable level, she pulled on her heavy coat, threw her backpack over her shoulder, and headed to one of her favorite spots. By the time she came back, the house would be warm and cozy. She set the alarm and locked the door behind her, then headed into town. It was a 2-block walk to Millie's coffee house. Livy Houston was a family friend, and over the years, Becca grew to love the cafe, the coffee, and especially the sweet tea, a secret recipe Livy said was passed down from her mother. It was Friday afternoon, and the cafe was mostly empty when Becca found a table by the window, not too far from the warmth of the fireplace. Though a latte would keep her alert, she had been off caffeine for 4 months, and instead settled on a sweet tea, which she was sure had enough sugar to compete with the coffee. Pulling out her textbook and notes, it was not half an hour before Becca was lost in con law and the intricacies of various Supreme Court rulings. The more she read, the more notes she produced. She
She pulled other research materials from her bag, and soon the little table at Millie's was a cluttered mess. Even the chair next to her contained dog-eared notes and a softback research book. Becca logged 2 hours and a couple of sweet teas, along with multiple trips to the bathroom, before she leaned back in her chair and stretched. She needed a break. From her purse, she produced a small, hardcover journal. She wasn't always a diary girl. The thoughts and desires and fears that found the pages of her journal were private things shared with no one, not even Gale, and certainly not published on the journal blogs she often read. Becca hadn't chronicled her entire life, like many of the girls who took to the internet to share their entries, but she was very consistent since freshman year. She made daily entries, sometimes every other day. Some were long descriptions of her life and feelings, others short quips about love and the goings-on of a college student. This afternoon at Millie's coffee house, she chronicled the last days of her life, her recent trip to the doctor, her fears of an early delivery, and the way Jack had talked her through and calmed her down, the way he always did. She wrote about her impromptu trip to Summit Lake and of the weekend she hoped to spend with a man she loved. She filled 2 pages before Libby Houston appeared from the back of the cafe.
"Hello, Becca," Libby said.
Becca looked up from her journal with a large smile. She stood and hugged her old babysitter.
"What are you doing up here?"
Libby asked, as she sat down at the table across from Becca. "Studying, unfortunately." Becca sat also. "I have a big test next week and needed to get away to make sure I absorbed it all." Nervous that Livy would ask about her journal, Becca slipped it under the table and onto the empty chair next to her.
"Are your parents with you?"
"No, my dad starts a trial next week, so he's been super busy. They said I could have the house to myself."
"So you have a great, big, quiet house to study in, and you're here?"
Becca smiled. "I love this place. It's perfect for studying, but I'm about to head back to the house. I'm almost done."
"How's school going?"
"Good," Becca nodded. "You know, it's law school. Some things are interesting, some things are terribly boring." Livy pointed to the papers on the table.
"This?"
Becca shrugged. "Constitutional law? It's okay, not my favorite. I guess that's why I'm up here, making sure I get it straight."
"I talked to your mother a week back, and she said you're dating a bright and polite young man, works for a senator."
Becca smiled. Her mom and Livy were good friends, and Becca remembered spending many hours at the Houston household while growing up. Becca and Jenny Houston were one grade apart and close friends during grade school, but it was with Livy that Becca always felt closest. The two had a special relationship, and Becca supposed it started with a day. As a 10-year-old, she wet her pants while at the zoo with the Houston family. The ride was almost an hour, and by the time she told Livy of the emergency that was brewing, there was not enough time to get to the bathroom. A potentially mortifying experience was handled with such swiftness by Livy, who brought Becca to the parking lot and changed her into an extra pair of jeans she had in the minivan, then concealed the evidence until it was washed and folded the next day. Then not only did none of the kids find out, but Becca never had to tell her parents. Small cover-ups continued through her childhood and into adolescence. A broken lamppost was fixed without alerting the Eckersleys. Trash cans run over when Becca was first conquering the steep angle of her driveway were replaced overnight. Empty beer cans found in Jenny Houston's bedroom the night after Becca slept over were properly confronted, but never snitched to her parents. So it was not odd, after 30 minutes of talking with Livy, that Becca felt comfortable dishing a few secrets about Jack. Hell, all the secrets of her life sat silently in the journal next to her, and Becca was tempted to open to page 1 and start reading. She hungered to tell someone about the man she loved, about her marriage, and about the baby growing in her womb. Becca wanted to spill her secrets, so securely kept over the past year that she sometimes wondered if they were real. Wanted to open her mouth and let them all flow from her vocal cords and lighten the anchor they were on her life.
"It sounds serious, you and this young man," Livy said.
"It is serious. We're not just dating, you know?" Livy paused.
"Not really. What do you mean? You two are exclusive?"
Becca shook her head. "More than that." Livy's eyes grew wide.
"Becca Eckersley, are you engaged?"
Becca smiled, swallowed hard, and shook her head.
"Then what?"
You two are about to get engaged?
Becca took a deep breath and slowly exhaled. Remember when I peed my pants at the zoo when I was a kid?
Livy thought for a second, then nodded.
Remember how you kept that a secret?
Another nod.
This is the same thing, okay? Becca said. You can't tell anybody.
What is it?
Another deep breath.
I'm married.
Well, Rebecca Alice Eckersley, your mother didn't mention a word about it when I talked to her.
Becca took on a sheepish grin.
That's 'cause she doesn't know yet.
Chapter 36. Peter Ambrose, Summit Lake, March 15, 2012, Day 11. After breakfast with Kelsey, Peter headed to the hospital. He dropped his wallet and phone onto the top shelf of his locker and showered in the staff locker room. Donning blue scrubs and a long coat 20 minutes later, he attached his hospital ID to his breast pocket and rounded on patients for an hour and a half. An elderly man was having difficulty with a drainage tube Peter had placed after removing the man's gallbladder 2 days prior. It took Peter another hour to prep the patient and replace the failing stent. By the time he finished, it was close to 3 p.m. He entered his office and sat behind his desk. This was not his forte, tracking people down. He pulled out the information he had on Becca Eckersley's old roommate and got to work. After an hour of searching, he realized locating someone with only their first name was harder than he imagined. It was past 4 p.m. when he discovered a first-year Stanford law student named Gail Moss. Some more digging confirmed she attended George Washington University and roomed with Becca Eckersley freshman year. A solid hit. Peter wrote down 3 phone numbers he found from a search site online before he noticed the commotion in the hallway. Sticking the phone numbers in the breast pocket of his scrubs, he walked to the doorway of his office and saw uniformed police officers at the nurse's station. He left his office and slipped back into the staff locker room. From his locker, he grabbed his wallet and phone, noticing several missed calls and texts from Kelsey. A partial text was displayed. Peter caught only a sentence of it. Entire police force looking for us. Detective Madison was... Before he could swipe his phone and read the full text, the locker room door slowly swung open. In the mirror, Peter saw an officer walk through the door. Ducking below the row of lockers, he hurried into the shower area without being noticed. Entering a shower stall, Peter pulled the curtain closed and started the water, adjusting the shower head away from him. He stood close to the wall and tried not to get soaked. A full minute passed.
Dr. Ambrose? The officer called into the showers with an authoritative voice.
Peter ducked down a bit.
No, Dr. Ledger,
he yelled over the rush of water.
Ambrose is in the ER. Is there a problem with a patient?
No, doc.
No problems.
Peter waited, the minutes dragging by, until he finally peeked around the shower curtain. When he was sure he was alone, he walked out of the stall with his shower still running. In the back of the locker room was a service elevator. He climbed in and pressed the button for the basement. The elevator dropped into the bowels of the hospital, and Peter pulled open the accordion-like metal grate when he landed. He walked into a storage area filled with cleaning supplies stacked on tall shelves. Mops and buckets and electric floor polishers lined the walls, as did 5-gallon buckets filled with chemicals meant to rid the place of the many diseases that circulate and percolate and otherwise infest hospitals. Past the supply room, Peter entered the laundry area. Industrial washers and dryers rumbled with bedsheets and blankets. Towels and linens were stacked tall on large carts that employees pushed around. He caught more than one glance from the hospital employees who likely wondered what a physician, dressed in scrubs and a long coat trailing him like a cape, was doing in the basement. When Peter made it through the laundry room, he found himself in the delivery bays. 3 large garage doors were pulled open. The trailer of a semi-truck filled one bay. A forklift hummed as it lifted crated supplies from inside the trailer. At the second bay, a big rig was just arriving and backing into the spot, the beep, beep, beep filling Peter's ears as the truck was set in reverse. The third bay was open, and Peter walked to the edge and jumped down to the pavement. He pulled off his coat and dumped it, along with his hospital ID, into a garbage can. Then he walked from the back of the hospital and off campus. When he reached the lake,
He headed south, toward town. Far enough away now, he stole a glance back. The front of the hospital was filled with police cars, parked at odd angles and lights flashing. A similar scene was present in front of the ER entrance. He knew he wouldn't get far in blue surgical scrubs, and he didn't consider going home. Instead, he headed into town. There, too, he noticed heavy police presence. He took back streets and deserted alleys until he found a lakefront pub. He ducked in and found a booth in the corner. There were only two people in the establishment, both bellied up to the bar and not at all interested in Dr. Peter Ambrose. He ordered a Coke from the waitress and pulled out his phone. There were four text messages from Kelsey. The first warned that police would likely pay him a visit at his house or the hospital. The second told him she was holed up in Ray's apartment, writing a draft of the Eckersley article to send to her editor. The third was a request for a call back to let her know he was okay. And the final text told him that she and Ray had made a break in the case and were heading into the foothills to talk to one of the men from Becca's journal, whose family owned a cabin there. Peter dialed Kelsey's number, but the phone went straight to voicemail. The waitress delivered his soda, and Peter declined the menu she offered. He looked around the empty pub, keeping his eye on the front door. Finally, he pulled Gail Moss's contact info from his breast pocket. The first two numbers were misses, but on the third call, he convinced a pleasant young lady to connect him to Gail's dorm room. She answered on the third ring.
Hi, is this Gail Moss?
Yes. Who's this?
Hi, Gail. My name is Peter Ambrose. I'm a physician in Summit Lake, and I'm working on Becca Eckersley's case.
Are you with the police?
No, not exactly. But I'm trying to help them figure out what exactly happened that night. To Becca, I was hoping to ask you a few questions.
No one's talked to me yet. The police, I mean. They haven't asked me any questions.
Really? I'm sure they will soon. Things, as you can imagine, are still a little hectic up here. Gail, you knew Becca well, correct? You were roommates?
Yes, we were best friends.
I see. Do you know who Becca was dating?
Sure, Jack Covington. Peter scribbled down the name.
Did you know Jack?
Of course. We all went to school together. We were close friends. Peter collected his thoughts. He originally imagined having more time for this conversation.
Gail, do you know anything about Becca and Jack getting married?
Married? No, Becca wasn't married. I mean, I'm sure someday they would have gotten married. They were really in love. But no, she and Jack weren't married.
A pause. Do you know anything about Becca being pregnant?
What? No, you've got things mixed up, sir. Becca wasn't married, and she sure wasn't pregnant. That's ridiculous.
Did Becca and Jack have any problems?
Like what?
Like, was their relationship volatile or strained in any way?
No, they were totally in love. What are you getting at?
I know this will be confusing to hear, but there is a suspicion that Jack might have had something to do with Becca's death.
Jack? No, sir. You're on the wrong track.
I know it's hard to hear, you being friends with him and all.
It's not hard to hear. It's impossible.
Listen, Gail. There are some things developing here in Summit Lake that point to Jack being a strong suspect in this. There's evidence developing that suggests Becca and Jack married privately, just before she was killed. And it's been confirmed by one of my colleagues that Becca was pregnant the night she died.
Dr. Ambrose, I don't know anything about the evidence that Becca got married or that she was pregnant. I can only tell you that if those things are true, she never told me. And that would be very shocking. But one thing I'm certain about is that Jack Covington had nothing to do with Becca's death. He certainly didn't kill her.
Like I said, I know it's hard to hear, but I just need to get an idea.
You're not listening to me. It's not hard for me to hear. It's simply not possible.
No matter how unlikely it seems that Jack...
Sir, Gail said with force, it's not unlikely. It's impossible.
If you let me explain, I might be able to change your mind.
You'll never change my mind.
Why is that?
because Jack died the same day Becca did. Chapter 37. Becca Eckersley, Summit Lake, February 17th, 2012, the night of her death.
"Thanks a lot for this, Milt," Jack said as he settled into the small jet.
It sat 14 passengers, was owned by Milt Ward Industries, and was scheduled to leave Denver, Colorado at 2 in the afternoon and arrive in D.C. 3 hours later. From there, Jack would drive to Summit Lake and surprise Becca, who didn't expect him until the following evening. If things went well, he figured he would pull into Summit Lake about 10 p.m. When Milt Ward heard Jack's predicament, he told Jack to cancel his commercial flight for Saturday afternoon and jump on with the senator, who was heading back to D.C. Friday afternoon and was happy to help Jack out.
"It's no problem," Ward said. "Family always comes first. Before work, before a campaign, before everything. Understand?"
"Yes, sir."
Jack pulled out his laptop and tweaked a speech the senator was giving over the weekend to a group of coal miners. 30 minutes after takeoff, the small jet began to rumble with turbulence. Jack had never been on a plane until his first trip to George Washington University, but since joining Milt Ward's campaign, he logged many hours in the air. The turbulence went unnoticed until it grew strong enough to rattle his laptop and spill his soda. He looked around the small plane and noticed a few other concerned faces and fake smiles. A sudden dip of 100 feet sent screams through the cabin. Jack slapped his computer closed and secured it next to him, quickly folding the tray table closed and forgetting about the spilled soda. Another deep dip and more screams. Then a thud, like the jet hit something solid. The turbulence continued. One more dive, and the oxygen masks fell from the ceiling and dangled in erratic fashion around the cabin. Jack gripped the elbow rests while a strange cold filled the cabin. Then another dip, unlike the others. This was a continuous dive, one that never ended. Until 4 minutes later, when the small jet crashed in a prairie outside Omaha, Nebraska. There were no survivors. 30 minutes after Becca left Millie's coffee house, with hair still warm from the hairdryer and wearing cozy sweatpants and heavy wool socks, she sat at the kitchen island of the Stilt house. She felt light and free. The heavy burden she carried for so long was finally lifted from her shoulders when she told Livy Houston about her and Jack's marriage. To get it out and off her chest, to simply tell someone, even if it was only her 50-year-old former babysitter whom she talked with twice a year, was a relief. Becca considered it practice for when she and Jack would soon have a similar discussion with her parents. Before diving back into con law, Becca pulled the ultrasound photographs from her purse. There were 8 pictures, black and white, spaced one on top of the other on a long piece of paper the technician printed during her last appointment. Becca looked at them now, studying the small baby growing in her womb. The tech showed her what she was looking at, and now Becca recognized the baby's hands and feet. She smiled when she thought of herself as a mother. Then she laughed out loud. What a crazy road. Folding the photos, she stuck them in a white business-size envelope. Then she pulled out a clean sheet of paper and laid it in front of her. She didn't know where the inspiration came from or what prompted her to write a letter to her unborn child, but somewhere in her heart, Becca wanted to communicate with a child growing in her womb. She wrote for 10 minutes before she signed the bottom with her initials, folded it in thirds, and slid the letter into the envelope along with the ultrasound photos. She wrote, "To my daughter," across the front, and placed the envelope on the corner of the kitchen island. She might have tucked the envelope into a private place had the thought come to her, maybe slipping it into the back pocket of her journal. But Becca was unaware, perhaps intoxicated by the freedom from her conversation with Livy Houston, that she had left her journal on the chair at Millie's coffee house. Chapter 38. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 15th, 2012, Day 11. They walked down the back stairs to the alley behind the cafe. "Wait here," Ray told her. "Under the stairs so nobody sees you. I'll get my car." Kelsey hid in the shadows of the stairs to Ray's apartment. Things had broken for them. and heading into the foothills to interview one of Becca's friends, who might provide insight into Becca and her relationship with Jack, was the best lead she had. That this young man might have been in Summit Lake the night of the murder was also an intriguing angle. Kelsey had to chase it. Getting out of town was not a bad idea either. As she took cover, with tiger stripes of late afternoon sunlight finding their way through the deck stairs and painting her face, an uneasiness set in. It felt like a lifetime since she decided to come to Summit Lake. In reality, it had only been 2 weeks since she fled Miami and her house and the office and the demons that hid along her once safe running path where this whole thing started. Commander Ferguson was gone. Fired because he offered her information about an unsolved murder in his small town. Peter was unreachable, and surely in a world of trouble for helping her. The town was teeming with police, and her hopes of escaping Summit Lake were placed in the hands of a 20-year-old girl she met a week and a half ago. If there was a picture of losing control, this was it. A car pulled around the corner and into the alley. The passenger side door swung open, and Ray leaned over the seats. "Get in!" Kelsey quickly climbed in, and they drove down the alley and turned right when they reached the end. "Stay down," Ray said. "They're on every corner. Maple Street is a traffic jam of police. This is crazy." "Do you know where you're going? How to get out to this house?" "She called it a cabin. I know the area, so I'll get us in the vicinity. She left directions, so when we're close, I'll have you navigate." With Kelsey slouched in the passenger seat, Ray drove through town and turned to avoid the congested main drag where squad cars lined the streets. The Winchester was their hub, with police milling around the entrance and on the street out front. Ray looked in her rear view when they got to the edge of town. She saw the "Welcome to Summit Lake" sign behind her, and a few minutes later, Kelsey sat up. 30 minutes after that, they entered the foothills to chase their lead. Chapter 39. Becca Eckersley. Summit Lake, February 17th, 2012, the night of her death. Becca stared at the letter to her daughter a moment longer, then opened her textbook and got back to work. Had she not been secluded in the mountains with the television off, Becca would have seen the news story that percolated across the country over the last few hours. Had she decided to take a break from studying and distract herself by clicking the browser on her laptop, she would surely have seen the story that was hot across the internet. A small jet owned by Senator Milt Ward had crashed not long after takeoff from Denver. Emergency crews were on site, as were federal investigators, but looking at the fiery wreckage, there were certainly no survivors. 12 members of the senator's campaign were on board. Instead, though, she was holed up in her parents' stilt house in the Blue Ridge Mountains, reading for an exam, and waiting for the man she loved to arrive the following day. Organizing herself at the kitchen island, she picked up where she left off at Millie's coffee house. Her iPod played subtle tunes, too low for her to catch the lyrics, but just enough to erase the still of the house. A half hour into studying, a noise outside the mudroom door overwhelmed the music. She stopped to listen. Too vague to identify, the noise held the ring of keys rattling, or maybe the door vibrating in the lake breeze. She turned the music down and listened more closely. Only silence followed. She clicked her iPod back on and returned to her textbook. It was 20 minutes later when 3 loud knocks came from the mudroom door. Startled, she jumped off the kitchen stool. She knew Jack was trying to get an earlier flight, and there was a remote chance Milt Ward would invite him to take a spot on his private jet. If he could make it happen, Becca knew it was possible that Jack could arrive tonight to surprise her. She didn't expect it, though. Wouldn't allow her mind to venture to the thought of sleeping in his arms tonight, since lying alone in the giant king bed would become a disappointment if Jack couldn't get in until tomorrow. But now, the 3 knocks on the door burst open the dam she had used to stymie her emotions. Jack managed to pull it off. He came a day early to spend time with her, to plan their conversation with her parents, to comfort her and love her and hold her in his arms and tell her it would all work out. Becca ran to the door, feeling foolish for worrying that Jack's job was beginning to overshadow their relationship. Jogging through the mudroom, a giddy feeling of anticipation filled her chest.
Chapter 40. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 15, 2012, Day 11. It was approaching evening as they drove into the foothills, with a dusky blue sky settling over the mountains and casting a teal shade to the narrow road they were following. "Here's the fork she was talking about," Ray said. "Okay," Kelsey said. A map was unfolded on her lap and her finger was marking their location. "Stay to the right." Ray maneuvered her car along the gravel road. The bush was thick on either side of them, with barely any clearance between the just-budded leaves and the car's windows. They drove more slowly now that the paved road was gone and gravel crunched under their tires. After 15 minutes, they came to the final T. "Play it again," Ray said. "Make sure we're going the right way." Kelsey pulled out her cell phone and replayed the message. On it was a female's voice that gave them directions to the cabin they were looking for. "Turn left at the final T and you'll run into it in 10 minutes. Ray swung the wheel to the left, and a few minutes later, they saw an isolated cabin in the distance. They slowed when they pulled to the front of the property. "Who lives out here?" Kelsey asked. "No one," Ray said. "These are hunting cabins. No electricity. Just propane generators and outhouses." She stopped at the front of the cabin and put the car in park. "Well, now what?" Kelsey opened the passenger side door. "Now we go talk to him. See what he knows about Becca, and if he can give us any insight into who she married." Chapter 41. Becca Eckersley, Summit Lake, February 17, 2012, the night of her death. Becca headed to the mudroom door, a smile coming to her face. She flicked on the outside light and pulled the curtains to the side. What she saw confused her. She looked more closely, squinted her eyes, and then smiled again, laughing. "Oh my God." Brad Reynolds stood on the landing outside the door. He had a heavy wool cap pulled to his eyebrows, and his bearded face offered a white fog of vapor into the cold night. She barely recognized him. Becca wondered many times over the past several months if she'd ever see her old friend again. The last image she had of him was when he was hanging from the rafters of Jack's apartment. That night, Jack rushed in to lift Brad by the waist and take the pressure off his neck after a full minute without oxygen. It took another minute to wrestle the noose free, and when the paramedics arrived, Brad was conscious and talking. Terribly emotional about his failed suicide attempt, he spent the night in the hospital until his parents took him home the next morning. Becca tried several times to contact him, but Brad was well buffered by his mother and father, who were not subtle about blaming Becca and Jack for what happened to their son. So shocked and excited to see him now, Becca tapped the alarm code and waited for the red light to turn green, then turned the deadbolt, unlatched the chain, and finally pulled open the door. Brad slipped in immediately. He had changed since she saw him last, almost 1 year ago. His hair was long and on the greasy side, which was odd since he always kept it short and manicured and still with gel. And he wore a beard that was thick and bushy, like a nonconformist college student so similar to everyone else that the hope of a beard and long hair might make him stand out. "What are you doing here?" Becca said. She wrapped her arms around him. Brad held her tight.
"I came to see you," he said.
She stood back from him, keeping her hands on his shoulders. "You look good, but different," Becca smiled. "You've gone backwoods on me." Brad's face was stoic. "So what have you been up to?" she asked. "You know, I tried to reach you a bunch of times. Your mom kind of told me to, you know, back off until you were ready to talk."
"Yeah,"
Brad said, staring over her head with lost eyes.
"She told me you called. I was just upset and embarrassed and just didn't want to talk to anyone."
"I was thinking of calling you again, but I didn't want to push. Here, come in out of the cold." He walked farther into the mudroom and she closed the door. "Come into the kitchen," Becca said. "I heard through the grapevine that GW said you could finish your last semester." Brad shook his head.
"Nah, I'm done with school.
Becca raised her eyebrows.
Well, give it some time. You might change your mind. They were both in the kitchen now, the iPod barely audible in the background.
I can't believe you're here. This is crazy. What are you doing up here? I mean, how did you know I was here?
I've been staying at my dad's hunting cabin. I don't know. For like a year now.
Becca paused. In the foothills?
Yeah. Needed to get away.
Really? For the entire year? There's no electricity out there, right?
No, there is. Propane generator.
This is the cabin where your dad hosted that attorney convention? My dad went a couple of years ago?
Yeah, that's the one. The old man canceled the convention this year. Didn't want to make me leave, I guess. Probably thought I'd move back in with him.
He let out an awkward laugh. Becca smiled and stared at her old friend, so different from what she remembered. Sometimes it's good to get away. There was a long pause as they both stood in the kitchen of the Stilt house. Well, Becca said, come on in, stranger. Let's get caught up on our lives.
Chapter 42. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 15th, 2012. Day 11. Peter sat in the dark pub and listened to Gail Moss tell her story. He knew, of course, about Senator Ward's plane crash. In the middle of the presidential primary race, it was the biggest news story around. That Becca's husband was on the plane was a development that destroyed Kelsey's theory about what happened that night.
And I would never tell you this, Gail said over the phone. But under the circumstances, I think it's important.
Peter cleared his throat.
What's that?
Becca liked a lot of attention. From guys, I mean.
Yeah? How so?
Don't get me wrong. I loved her. She was my best friend. But she sort of had this character flaw she wasn't aware of. At least, she always seemed oblivious to it.
To what?
The way she led guys on. She was just one of those girls who had a lot of boyfriends. I mean, friends who were boys. Way more than she had girlfriends. And, you know, guys hang around girls when they like them. Girls are different. They can see a guy as just a friend, but guys, you know, they always want more.
And why do you think this is important?
Because there was one guy who had a really serious relationship with Becca, and she sort of broke his heart. Not on purpose. Like I said, she didn't really know she was doing anything wrong, and I'm not saying she did.
Gail, Peter said. Who are you talking about? Whose heart did she break?
One of our friends from college. His name is Brad Reynolds. After Becca and Jack got together, he sort of freaked out. Tried to kill himself, then dropped out of school and fell off the grid. I heard he was living in his father's hunting cabin in the mountains.
Where?
There, in Summit Lake. Or, you know, the foothills. Way out. Like, with nothing around. He told me once that it was like an hour from Becca's place, and I just think it would make sense for the police to at least talk to him. I'm not saying he had anything.
I'll call you back.
Peter ended the call and scrolled through Kelsey's texts. Heading into the foothills to talk to one of Becca's friends. He scrambled with the keypad and tried Kelsey again, but her phone went straight to voicemail. He knew she was already too far into the mountains for cell reception. Peter pulled out his wallet and ripped through it until he found the business card. Then he dialed the number and hoped for someone to pick up. Chapter 43. Becca Eckersley. Summit Lake. February 17, 2012. The night of her death. Becca stood in her kitchen with Brad in front of her.
So, what's going on with your dad? You guys on any better terms?
Brad closed his eyes and shook his head. Becca could tell he was about to cry.
What's wrong?
She moved closer to him and placed her hand on his cheek, feeling the thick, coarse beard that covered his face. Brad took her by the wrist and pressed her hand harder to his cheek. Keeping his eyes closed, he asked,
You and Jack still together?
Becca nodded her head slowly.
Yeah.
Brad opened his eyes and stared at her.
So I've just got to know. because it's been killing me. Was there ever a chance for you and me?
Becca slowly pulled her hand away from his face. Brad, I'm really sorry for what happened. I'm still upset that I kept my relationship with Jack a secret for so long. A lot happened our senior year. Things that changed all our lives, forever. If I could go back and undo some of it, I would. But the thing is, I'm not sure I'd change the relationship I had with you. You were one of my best friends. I never knew you considered me anything other than the same. She looked at him for a long minute.
That's so hard for me to handle, Brad finally said. I just don't know how I read this whole thing so differently than you. I can't stop thinking that maybe I was just your backup plan.
My what?
Keep me around and interested in case nothing better came along.
Brad, that's ridiculous.
But then I guess Jack was different than me. The mysterious Jack Covington. Not really interested in law school, just for the resume. Never going to practice law, sort of a rebel. Not really our crowd, you know? Gonna be a writer someday.
Brad, come on. What you're saying isn't close to the truth.
I just...
Brad ran a hand through his disheveled hair, pulling the cap from his head.
Were you really going to get a C in business law?
Becca squinted her eyes. What?
See, I stole that test to help you. Because you convinced me that without it, you'd mess up your transcripts. Screw up your chance at law school. Jack thought you were just playing the situation for attention. And I still don't know. Maybe you were manipulating the whole thing and would have done fine without the test. Just like you manipulated me and our relationship when you used to sleep in my bed all night.
I'm so sorry I hurt you. It was never my intention. After another moment, he began to cry. What can I do for you?
You can get me the girl I fell in love with. The same one who told me she loved me too.
There was a long stretch of silence, filled by the subtle rhythm of the iPod.
This is where you broke my heart, Brad finally said. When I came up here after Christmas, found you with him.
Becca nodded. I'm sorry. Brad looked around the house for an instant, then back to Becca.
Where is he anyway?
The question, and the way it was posed, put a scare into Becca's chest. A quick synapse fired in her mind, triggering an awareness that the sound she heard earlier was the handle of the mudroom door being tried from the outside. Her brain registered again, and she thought back to a few evenings before in Foggy Bottom, when she struggled to unlock her apartment door and panicked that someone was behind her. The same feeling came to her now, as Brad stood in her kitchen.
He's with the senator, right? Running all over the country, thinking he's some kind of hot shot. It's so funny, Becca. You can't see what's so obvious.
Brad laughed, a frantic fake wheeze.
It's freezing outside. What if the heat went out tonight, or the water lines froze? What if you needed him tonight? He's not here for you. I would never do that. Leave you all alone, or let you come up to the mountains by yourself?
The volume of his voice was elevating with each sentence, and Becca heard a slur in his words.
I would never leave you alone.
Why did he? His voice softened.
It's because he doesn't appreciate you.
It's his job, Brad.
Don't make excuses for him!
The sudden outburst sent Becca's adrenaline flowing. She still had her cell phone in her hand and was tempted to dial 911, but she wasn't sure what was happening, or if she could call the police on her friend. Brad, she said, trying to calm the situation and figure a way to get him out of the house. It was all she wanted, to be alone, to call Jack and tell him to come home. I'm fine, she said, forcing away tears and smiling to hide her fear. Okay, I don't need Jack tonight. I don't need anything tonight. Let's talk about this tomorrow. She walked back into the mudroom.
No, I'm done talking. I've talked to myself about this for a year.
When she turned around, he was close to her. His eyes rattled in their sockets. Becca noticed the strange vibration, his irises twitching and fast forward.
She remembered reading somewhere of the way narcotics cause the muscles of the eyes to fire as the central nervous system is altered by their impact.
"You know what?" she said, sliding past him so she was in the doorway of the mudroom, trying to get him to commit to the side door. "Let's have lunch tomorrow, and then we can have a long..." He grabbed her by the shoulders, and in a violent surge, yanked her through the mudroom and into the kitchen, pinning her to the wall. Startled by the sudden onslaught, Becca dropped her cell phone and put her hands on his wrists.
"Didn't it mean anything to you when we kissed?"
His teeth were gritted.
"Or is that just what you do with every guy you meet? Tease him and pull him along until you have a couple to choose from and then run off with one of them."
"Brad, don't hurt me."
"Hurt you? I love you. Why don't you understand?"
He tightened his grip on her shoulders and pinned her harder against the wall.
"Brad, I'm pregnant. Don't hurt my baby."
A disgusted look came across his face.
"That's why you've been to the doctor so much. So classy that you let him knock you up."
"Brad, we got married. Privately, we just decided..."
"Yeah, you guys do everything privately."
There was something in his eyes she couldn't name. Some combination of shock and resignation. For an instant, his arms went slack. His shoulders drooped, and his grip on her shoulders loosened. But as soon as Becca pushed him away, Brad's eyes went wide with rage, like a bolt of lightning had hit him. Unprepared for his onslaught, she felt her heels skid and drag across the tile floor until he slammed her against the adjacent wall. Clutching her shoulders, then a fistful of hair at the base of her skull, he wrestled her around the kitchen. Panic wiped her mind blank. All the ideas and images there just seconds before, erased now, allowing her fight-or-flight instincts to take over. As he dragged her violently through the house, Becca fought for her life. Grasping and kicking at anything that might help her, she saw her textbook and laptop scattered to the floor. The envelope, containing the letter to her unborn child, sailed through the air and landed in the corner of the kitchen as her wool-stockinged feet struggled for traction on the cold tile. As he jerked her through the room, Becca's legs scissored back and forth. A wild kick met the kitchen hutch, sending dishes shattering across the floor. With the chaos in the kitchen still settling, bowls rolling, stools bouncing, she felt the carpet of the family room under her feet. It gave her leverage, and Becca used every bit of it to push him away. But her resistance only fueled Brad's rage. He wrenched her head backward, ripping a clump of hair from her scalp as her feet left the ground and her body went horizontal. As she fell, Becca felt her head crack against the wood frame of the couch as he heaved himself on top of her. The pain in her head vibrated down her spine. Her vision blurred, and the noise of the world began to fade, until his ice-cold hands thrust into her sweatpants. This snapped her back to consciousness. As the weight of his body pinned her down, she punched and clawed until her knuckles broke and her nails became thick with skin and blood. When she felt her underwear rip away, she screamed a piercing, shrill cry. But it lasted only a few seconds, until his hands found her throat and crushed her voice into raspy gasps. He was vicious and possessed as he silenced her, his hands clamping with a powerful rage around her neck. She sucked for air, but it would not come. And soon her arms fell like deflated balloons to her sides. And though her body could no longer respond to the panicked calls from her mind, she still resisted, by never breaking eye contact with him, until her vision faded like her voice. Broken and bleeding, she lay there, her chest barely rising with shallow breaths. She drifted in and out, waking each time he brutalized her in angry, violent waves. It went on for an eternity before he left her. Before he fled through the sliding glass door of the family room, leaving it wide open. As the cold night air filled the room and crept over her naked body, Becca's eyelids fell to slivers. All that was left now was white halogen glowing in the doorframe, bright against the dark night. Becca lay motionless, unable to blink or look away had the desire come to her. It did not. She was strangely content in her paralysis. Tears slid down her cheeks and climbed the curve of her earlobes before dripping silently to the floor.
The worst was over. The pain was gone. He was no longer on top of her, and his absence was all the freedom she wanted. His fists no longer pummeled her, and her throat was finally free from his crushing grip. His hairy thighs had stopped rubbing over her, and his hot breath was gone from her face. On the floor with her legs splayed and arms like two broken tree limbs attached to her sides, she faced the wide-open patio door. The lighthouse in the distance, with its bright beacon calling out to lost boats in the night, was all she knew and all she needed. It was life, and she clung to its swaying image. Far away, a siren bounced through the night, low at first, then gathering strength. Help was coming, although she knew it was too late. Still, she welcomed the siren and the aid it would bring. It was not herself she was hoping to save.